Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. Now, if this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as improving your business and your business life, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. And having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, you can all do me a big favor. Please check out some of our past shows at AnswersForTheFamily.com to hear some informative, entertaining guests as well as some dynamic co-hosts. They're going to discuss ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, I'm happy to say that joining us today as my guest co-host is Joelle Jacobson. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, a former school counselor, and a neurofeedback clinician. Joelle has been working with children, adolescents, adults, and families in California for over two decades, offering therapeutic services in her private practice as well as via her telemental health video conferencing platform. She is also well-versed in treatment placement for mental illness, substance use disorder, and eating disorders. So, Joelle, now we're going to be discussing cultural brilliance in organizations with our guest. What are some of the things that parents can do to keep the best possible cultural brilliance in their family?
Well, Ellen, I just want to thank you for having me on the show. I love what you do. It's such important work. And I'm really looking forward to speaking with Claudette. As far as cultural brilliance in the family, parents really need to be on the same page. And if they're not, they need to speak to a professional to help them get on the same page. It's important for parents to show a united front so the child knows they can count on what is being told to them. If they see that the parents are in disagreement, they will manipulate. That's just what, yeah. That's just what they'll do. Children feel safe when they know what is expected of them. When they feel that their parents are not in control, children begin to exhibit behaviors of feeling out of control. And none of these behaviors are positive, unfortunately. It can range from a decline in school participation, dropping out of school, dropping out of sports, bullying, misbehaving at school and home, experimenting with alcohol or other drugs, vaping, self-injury, and disordered eating patterns. So it's really important to get to the family before that happens, because unfortunately these behaviors don't happen in a funnel. Mm-hmm. And parents really need to look at their behavior in order to help their child. So a lot of times parents will come into my office and say, well, you know, she's doing this, he's doing this, and it's really the parents that are role modeling behaviors for the child. It could be the parents that are bringing in their own unresolved issues from their childhood and their how they were parented. You know, we don't come from the same families, and when we get married, mm-hmm. we bring both of our childhood experiences into family. So it's really important that that is resolved before, you know, if that could be a rule, before you have children, resolve your stuff before you start having children, things would be a lot smoother.
You know, you mentioned a great point when you talked about the parents appearing to be in control, that when they appear to not be in control, it brings more chaos. One of the things that I have found to be strange, I guess, is that, you know, I speak with so many teenagers after they've run away or after they have gone out and lived on the streets, and they say, well, they left the family because the family was trying to put too much structure on them, trying to tell them what to do. And yet I find some of these kids have gone out and joined gangs, and the structure is actually so much more confining, and there's so many more rules. And the irony of it is that, you know, here they're looking for something and they find something that's even more controlling than what they could possibly imagine.
Right. And you know, of course, your expertise is the trafficking, and it's so dangerous when children run away, because then, you know, you could either never see them again, or by the time they do get away from the traffickers, you know, 7 years later, there's so much trauma that they're in years of treatment if they ever do get better, if they're ever able to get back into society and live a normal life.
So what would you say the one most important thing can be for parents who have a child who is chronically running away to be able to reel that in?
Well, I think it's important that the parents really show, again, a united front. And if, you know, if one parent is feeling that, oh, it's okay if they go out and kind of explore, maybe they just need to, you know, not be in the house as much, you know, sometimes there's, you know, because the parent that makes the excuses, the enabler.
Yes.
It's not actually helping.
Right.
Right. So as we know, and then there's the parent, you know, I had a family come in, and it was very similar, that, you know, blaming the child. And this was a situation where there was a decline in grades and general apathy. And, you know, parents were brought up very different parenting styles. Dad was very controlling and strict. Mom was not controlling at all and nurturing, but overcompensating for dad's controlling behavior, which the more dad controlled, the more the child didn't want to be at home, mm-hmm. you know, and she wouldn't necessarily run away, but she would be with her friends out all night. Mom wasn't setting boundaries. And then eventually her grades started to drop so drastically that she was in danger of graduating. And I think that's what initially brought them into my office. But it's really important that when mom comes in to save the child, she understands that she's actually not saving her. She's hurting her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and when parents don't know what to do, they have to speak to a professional.
Yeah.
They have to speak to a mental health professional, because it doesn't happen in a funnel. There's a reason why this child is running away. They need to call someone like you to help explain, you know, what may be going on with this child and how serious it is if this child is picked up by a trafficker.
Now, to me, the overall thing that I hear from you is that, you know, a lot of these families, the family culture is in chaos, really,
right.
You know, and fortunately, we're going to be able to talk more about that and how that works in businesses as well. But if there's anybody out there that would like to get in touch with Joelle to go into more detail on this, her website is teentalkline.org. And her toll-free phone number is 855-411-8336. Now, if you're driving and you can't write this down, you can always go to the answersforthefamily.com site, and we will have all that information there. All right. Now, also, for those that have become very in tune to knowing where our kindness expert is, joining us is Bobby Folsom, who is the manager of our kindness expert and one of the founders of Dare to Be Kind movement. Because Gabriella is out and about as she is, I will ask Bobby the question that is on many people's lips: where in the world is Gabriella?
That's kind of a good question, Alan. Happy to fill in here. Sorry, Gabriella couldn't be on the call. It's my understanding, as of a couple of hours ago, she's in the middle of Nebraska somewhere. She left this morning, and the reception and phone service is really spotty. So she is actually on her way to California. and she'll be spreading that kindness all throughout California. She's also going to be meeting up with her sister from Japan in Los Angeles, so very exciting that they'll spend some time together. And while she's traveling and doing her public speaking, Tomoko and I will be busy lining up speaking engagements for her and various places that she will be volunteering and interviewing for her TV series, and it's go, go, go. And I think she left pretty excited this morning as while she was in Europe, I had her car lettered, so she now has the Dare to Be Kind in the window and the website, and she has a kindness mobile on the road. So that's very exciting, and I'll be posting a video of that later on the Dare to Be Kind movement.
I love that. So for everybody out there, okay, yeah. Keep your eye out for the Dare to Be Kind mobile. And now for anybody, if somebody is out there and they want Gabriella to come to their organization and speak, or they want to go on the website, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you or with her?
Yes, everything. If you go to the Dare to Be Kind movement.com, everything's on there. My phone number's on there. Gabriella's also on Facebook. She answers all of her messages. She comments on everything. And it doesn't take much to get a hold of us.
Good.
And we watch that like a hawk. And yes, if you'd like her to come your way, just give us a holler. If we're anywhere close, I promise it will happen.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for taking the time. Give my best to Gabriella. And for those out there that are listening, she will be with us on the air and in studio next Monday. So if you have other questions for her, you can call in then. So, Bobby, again, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And I know she's really excited to be back in the studio with you, Alan. So I'll be listening to that show.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. You're so welcome.
All right. Bye now. Now, for Bye-bye. Everybody out there, so we're going to talk a little bit about company culture. So imagine for a moment a company culture that proactively responds to change in ways that decrease stress, inspires learning, and promotes organizational health. Imagine employees who are engaged and motivated to deliver innovative results on a consistent basis. This isn't a fantasy. It is attainable. It's what is at the heart of a brilliant culture. And it's what we need to stay ahead of any always in flux marketplace. And I'm happy to say that we have the right person to discuss this and more. We have Cultural Brilliance CEO, who is our guest today, Claudette Raleigh. She is a change management consultant. She's a cultural designer, and she's an executive coach. She helps leaders and organizations resolve complex organizational problems in ways that honor the intelligence of their cultural systems and at the same time, the brilliance of their people. Now, for almost 20 years, Claudette has consulted, trained, and coached executive leaders and teams at Fortune 500 companies, small businesses, higher education, and startups to create proactive and innovative workplace cultures that deliver outstanding results throughout all areas of an organization. Now, with a client list that includes many, including Medtronic, Boston University School of Law, and MIT, Claudette's unique programs solve complicated problems, and they create a buy-in and an engagement that has received incredibly high reviews. She is the creator of Cultural Brilliant Systems and hosts a global syndicated radio show on the subject. She also teaches a course on cultural and communication at Northeastern University and is the author of Cultural Brilliance, the DNA of Organizational Excellence, a step-by-step guide to achieve the greatest in your organization. Claudette, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it is great to have you, and I think that we are at a time that I think that this is just an incredibly important thing as we become so focused on these large companies, and as we have millennials now coming out of colleges and looking for where they're going to go to work. I think that this is a time in which this type of training, I think, is really, really important. So share with us a little bit. I mean, what inspired you to write a book on cultural brilliance?
Oh, I'm happy to. So the book, as you mentioned, I've been working in organizations for about 20 years as a consultant and coach. And one thing I noticed over and over again was that even if I was in a company to help them with communication or leadership, you know, whatever the case was, almost always culture was at the root of whatever was happening that wasn't working well in an organization. So I decided I wanted, you know, it's a big problem to solve, right? How do we improve organizational cultures and give them a way to transform? So I decided I wanted to take that on. And that's the outcome of that is the book Cultural Brilliance, which, as you mentioned, outlines a path forward that organizations can take to really understand their culture, design a change, and transform it.
So, I mean, explain the difference. You know, I think that many people that have worked in different businesses see that there is a different type of culture in probably, you know, most any company. But, you know, when you go into a situation and you're looking at it, so what is a brilliant culture? How can you see that they either have a brilliant culture, or how do you know that you can get them to a brilliant culture?
Yeah, so brilliant. So when I think about brilliant cultures, I think about them in two ways. One is that brilliance is really about potential. And so we know the word brilliance means a lot of things: intelligence, brightness, right, light. There are a lot of different ways you can look at that word. But I think it also means potential. So most organizations, like you said, you can go in and you can see there's some things that work well and some things that don't. But almost all companies are leaving organizations. Are leaving potential on the table in the form of their culture. They don't have the culture they could have. You know, it's the same kind of potential when we say potential in individual people, right? You can see someone could be so much more than maybe they're behaving right now, or the way they think about themselves could be so much more positive, and it would change their behavior. Organizations, I think, are largely similar in that way. I also talk about brilliance in the sense that, and what you choose the second part of your question, how do you know if a culture is brilliant? One of the ways is that organizations able to adapt to change, but it's able to do it in a ways that actually decrease the stress in the organization and increase the learning, increase the overall success and health of the organization. So instead of adapting to change in ways that actually, you know, amp up the stress to the point that people are getting ill, which happens in some companies, mm-hmm. It's actually looking at change really, really differently. The other hallmark of it is that there's a high trust in the culture. I don't think you can have a brilliant culture or even a very good culture without high levels of trust in the organization. So there's that emotional safety that allows people to make mistakes, to admit they've made mistakes, to learn from those mistakes, to use those in the service of excellence, to speak their mind, to disagree with each other. And again, in the service of excellence, in the service of bringing forth the best parts of the organization. And the last way I think that you know an organization's brilliant is you go in and the energy's good, right? People want to be there. The company's successful. They're maybe contributing to the community. Their people are growing and developing. And there's just something about that culture that makes people want to be there.
And I think that's a great point when you say it makes people want to be there, because we hear stories about some of the newer businesses, you know, or that are also large, and it could be an Amazon or a Google, where they talk about the fact that they are they're setting different standards, they're setting different times to work, or they're setting up things that where you have essentially playtime within work. You know, what are some of the things that that you think has made the biggest difference in some of these newer businesses that are now maybe changing the way in which we look at how we maximize business?
So in the book, I mentioned a study that Google did, which is something that's gotten a lot of press, a lot of media. But they did a study to find out why their most successful teams were successful, right? And there were several facets, but the number one reason those teams had the success that they had is because they built that trust I just mentioned called psychological safety. So these teams were able to innovate. So you can't have it. You can't innovate without trust. So when we see newer companies doing really innovative things, whether it's in technology or another field, it's often because the foundation of all of that is that they've built an environment where it's psychologically safe, which means a team is safe for interpersonal risk taking, which means if I disagree with someone on my team, I'm not going to be worried they're going to stab me in the back, or there's going to be retribution later, or someone's going to gossip about me. So that's one of the things that holds a lot of those companies. They're all very different. Every culture is like a fingerprint. So there's differences, but it's one thing that connects them. You also see in those companies that they really are overt about their culture, meaning if they hire people who will enhance their culture. They look at, you know, when someone new comes in, they really onboard people. They make sure people understand the culture and what's expected of them within that culture. And I think that's also a really key point, that we know culture evolves whether we're being intentional or not. And those companies like Amazon, Google, et cetera, Facebook, are doing a really good job being intentional about their culture when they bring new people in.
I love what you've said. This is Joelle. Do you see the companies that have the biggest challenges, maybe that they're not really enforcing work-life balance, that that's not a priority for them?
Yeah, that can definitely be part of it. And work-life balance, I think it's also when there's low trust, and usually with low trust comes people not feeling valued. People not feeling respected or being respected. And so in organizations where there's trust and respect and people feel valued, I've noticed that the work-life balance piece is also handled because people are treated with respect. So of course we don't want you to burn out and get sick, right? We want to do something that makes sense. And those companies are usually also getting employee feedback. They're listening to the feedback. Like, it would be helpful if we had this or that. You know, what if I was able to work, you know, half my, you know, one day a week at home, that would really allow me to have more balance, you know, something like that.
Right. I mean, that is really what seems to drive a lot of the issues, that there's such a high burnout rate because companies aren't looking at the lack of productivity when people are overworked and they're not able to figure out how to do the work-life balance. So you coming into the company and pointing that out is so important, you know, to help the culture and turn it into a culture of brilliance.
You know, and one of the questions that I was thinking is that, so if somebody is out there and we're running a business and we feel like we're not really maximizing, you know, all of our assets, you know, if you're to walk in, I mean, how can somebody tell that their culture is in trouble, or are there particular warning signs that maybe by somebody just listening and knowing that, you know, if I have these warning signs, it's time to call you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Happy to share some warning signs. So Joelle just mentioned this drop in productivity. If you see a drop in productivity that's systemic, it's an operational drop in productivity, not a one-time situation that you know the root cause of, you probably have a culture issue. Innovation, even at an operational level, you probably have a cultural issue. There's something going on beneath the surface. If your company tolerates bullying behavior, you have a cultural issue. That is an unbelievably disrespectful environment to allow people who work for you to continue to exist in, right? So bullying behavior is a big warning sign. Also, if your meetings are silent and or boring, you probably have an issue to address, right? And again, I mean, you know, chronically, not once or twice, right? Things happen and go wrong, and we can resolve them. But if it's something that, you know, it's again systemic, because it means if people aren't speaking up and they're not sharing thoughts and ideas, then either there's low trust, or they don't feel safe, or they think the meeting's not valuable. But there's something that's not being said that needs to be said. So there's probably something going on in your culture. One more I'll mention that is sometimes people are surprised by is sometimes I find that open space environments work environments, workspaces, they don't always fit the needs of the, either the people who are working in them or the industry. And so I think that's always, it fascinates me. And sometimes it's a red flag of a cultural issue. So we have an open space environment, and it's so silent that a pin could drop. And I've been in some companies like that. And the point of the open space environment is to increase collaboration, but mm-hmm. I have to go book a conference room to have a conversation with somebody. Those dots don't fit together for me. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So that would, to me, that starts to signal. I start asking questions about, how did you decide to have this environment? Did you get input from employees? What kind of environment do they need to work in to really thrive and collaborate, in their work? So that's a less obvious one, but it's really interesting to see how those things work and don't work.
So how would you say things have changed, let's say, over the last 20 years now that you've been doing this, in regards to business 20 years ago versus business today? What are the biggest changes that you've seen, both on a negative or a positive side?
Mm-hmm. I think we're all familiar with, work-life balance and the rapid rate of communication and change, spurred by technology and our different ways of communicating now. So that's a change that I think has pros and cons to it. I think a really great change is, over the last 20 years, it used to be that, and I remember this from when I worked in organizations, which was prior to 20 years ago, that you went to work, and if whether you liked it or not was not nearly as important as it is now. That people, especially younger generations, saying, we want work, we want to like our work, we want to be in great cultures, we want to be contributing to the world and the environment. We want something that's based on our strengths. And so you see that people are asking more from the workplace, I think, in really positive ways. People aren't willing to put up with lack of trust nearly as much. We've seen that, certainly in our global culture as well, the U.S. culture, where we see that there are different movements, right, that have emerged saying, no, things need to change. We can't keep the status quo. And I think that's really impacting, how we deal with things at work, the things that are tolerated and the things that are no longer tolerated. And I think that's huge. The last piece I'll mention is the conversation about culture, right? We would not have been talking about this 20 years ago, or probably even 10 years ago. I wouldn't have written this book. People didn't talk about culture very much. And if they did, no one really knew what you were talking about.
I think you bring up a great point. And we have a listener question that has come in. And again, I want to take the time to thank those that take the time to send in questions, either through email or through instant message. But this one reads, I work in a company with over 200 employees. I feel very fortunate to have a position with a decent salary with full medical benefits. Unfortunately, the working environment has gotten very stressful, as the staff seem to feel that they must compete with each other instead of working in healthy teams to accomplish projects. As an administrator, I watch them jostle for attention and for who is going to be king of the pile. I would love my boss to read your book. So when you say that you work with companies, I'm curious how your program helps a situation such as this. And this is from Peggy in Texas.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Peggy, for calling in. That's always a tough environment when competition, right? Competition is the way of operating. It really, you lose a lot in your culture. Sorry going through that. But I think, so my book, in a situation like that, one of the things that we do first is we're really assessing how the culture operates now. Because my belief is you can't change what you don't understand, or if you do, it's not going to go well, right? We've all been in that experience. So it's really assessing, what kind of culture do we have now as an organization? What kind of culture do we need to have to really succeed, to have our company be as successful as it can be? And when I say success, I also mean that employees are bought in and part of it, that employees are thriving, not success at the expense of employees. And then once we understand the kind of culture you have now and the culture you want, need to have to support where you're going as an organization, we design how to bridge that gap, right? What are aspects of the culture that need a shift and change? What wants to emerge within the culture and the organization for improvement? And then we have a plan for implementation. But that's at a high level. But it's something that really, we do a lot of truth telling at the beginning around how that culture, how your culture operates, and get people engaged from all levels of the organization. This is not just change with the leaders. The leaders mm-hmm. are a big part of the change, but we need everybody to be part of it, because everybody has that, you know, a part of that 360 view of the culture. Everybody has part of the truth about how that culture operates.
Now, in a situation like that, where they're saying there's 200 employees and they seem to be competing with each other, how much of that is a human resources issue, where the type of people that you're hiring, versus is this something to where, from an upper management, are they putting pressure that, you know, where you're sort of dangling carrots that is making people compete? Where do you see that issue more?
I would say, you know, typically it's something in the culture, you know, and again, without having, you know, all the information, it's typically in the culture. If you see people, so culture drives behavior, right? So what we know about culture is that it's a set of beliefs that drive behavior in an organization. So if people are behaving in a certain way, like being competitive with each other, it's either part of the underlying belief in the culture, or they're overtly told to, right? This is how to succeed in this company, right? Which can be unspoken and spoken. So when if it was just a couple people being competitive, that might be a hiring issue, like you said. But if you see it throughout the company, then it's part of the culture. It's part of how people know to it's like the operating system in the organization.
Claudette, I have a question from Stephanie in Kansas. She asks, I work at a company where the men still get paid more than the women, even though they have equal qualifications. How would you handle the gender inequity issue?
Well, that's a hard one also. I think, you know, something like this is challenging. And I know when women try to address this, then, you know, they need to do this carefully. If I were in those shoes, I'd be going to human resources. If I trusted my manager or boss, I'd address it with that person also. So I'd be looking for people I could go to that were trustworthy. And I'd also be looking at, you know, if your state has any particular laws around pay equity, anything like that, I'd want to have some information also. But I'd look for those people who are allies, people I trust, and set up some private conversation, you know, confidential conversations with them, and raise this issue. Depending again on the organization and where, you know, Stephanie works within the organization, you know, it may even be something that could be brought up to, you know, any external stakeholders in the organization, maybe the board. Again, without having more information, I don't know exactly the strategy to use. But I think that the first step is really to raise this in a confidential way to the right people in the organization. That's an issue.
That's a great answer, though, really, to be prepared to look at what the laws are locally. And I think sometimes it's challenging to go to HR because HR is getting paid from the company. And so even though, you know, it's supposed to remain confidential, I think people just are, you know, have that trepidation. You know,
sure.
To go to them.
Absolutely.
But I agree. I don't think there's any other way than to go to HR or the board I think that's a great advice.
Now, using that as an example, at what point would you say that it would be it would make sense to go higher than HR or higher than your immediate supervisor? Because I know there's a lot of corporations that'll really push this, you know, use the chain of command. But if the chain of command is broken, and if the person, you know, so you have somebody that's in a position and they're seeing that for gender or for whatever reason, they are choosing to discriminate how somebody is paid, at what point does it then make sense to go higher up within the company, to go to somebody higher and say, look, this is your company. I don't believe that you are wanting this to happen. And I know that you can't watch everything. So somebody needs to let you know this is what's going on. How often does that become a positive, or does that still fall under that thing of, you know, you're kind of breaking the chain of command?
Yeah, great question. I think you know, you, you know, we do our best with the chain of command if there is one. And then if you can't get anywhere, then I think, again, being very prepared, is as prepared as you can be and as strategic as you can be, absolutely setting up a meeting with someone. Like you said, this is positioning it this way. This is your company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, whatever you know about this person and what they value, right? You value fairness or you value whatever, and set and lay out the information, right? So if someone knows that women are getting paid less than men, is that, do they have data to back that up, right? Or is that, mm-hmm. is that just something that's commonly known in the company, but finding a way to bring evidence and facts and data with you, is a huge way to advocate for things that are important. So really being prepared is key. But I think, yeah, if you've tried the usual avenues, and it's something really important, as pay equity certainly is, it may be the time to talk to somebody different higher up in the company.
Good. I like that. Now we're going to take a break, but I want to ask a question and I'd like you to think about it and for everybody to stay with us and we can get the answer after the break. But having worked with so many large companies, again, Fortune 500 companies, what would you say are the biggest mistakes that leaders make regarding their organizational culture? So for everybody out there, you're listening to Answers for the Family. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We are talking with Claudette Raleigh, and we are talking about cultural brilliance. So, Claudette, when we went to break, the question that I had asked was, having worked with so many Fortune 500 companies, you know, what would you say are the biggest mistakes that you have seen leaders make regarding their organizational culture?
I love this question. Thanks for asking it. Because the two answers to it, the first one is not listening. Not listening. And by that, I mean not listening to employee feedback. And what some leaders do is they listen only to what they want to hear. So I call this listening to what you hear. So there's really something powerful in listening as a leader to all the things that you want to hear and all the things you didn't want to hear. And some leaders I've noticed will select to listen to only the things that they like. But now, while it may be painful to hear, you know, people will tell you things you don't want to hear that may be actually emotionally painful for some leaders to hear. Absolutely. But it's incredibly important because I've seen such amazing change happen when a leader finally internalized and took in information from those who work at the company. And they really got a full picture of what was going on, and then they could take better action. The other thing I'll say is that leaders who have, in my experience, all leaders have, you know, just like all people do, all have some blind spots about their culture simply because one person can't see everything, right? So a mistake a leader will make is actually not asking for feedback about their blind spots around the culture. What's going on in the culture that you think I need to be aware of is an amazingly helpful question when we're in the middle of cultural change and creating an environment that allows people to feel safe enough to tell that person the truth.
All right. Well, we have another listener question that has come in. And this one says, I own a small sports training and product company with a dozen employees. Most are millennials, as this is the client age we serve. Being 30 years their senior, this age group's working style is pretty tough to deal with for me. Sometimes I feel like a total outsider when trying to set protocols and manage workflow. Would your book be useful in dealing with these challenges, and would it be more beneficial to me or to them? And this is from Ben in New York.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ben. I think initially, since it's your organization, your store, probably you reading it first, and then it could also be beneficial for them. But what's occurring to me is when you talked about the differences in work styles, is having a conversation, and maybe you've done this, but having a conversation about with them that's really open and honest about what you're experiencing, talking with them and asking them what they're experiencing, and how together you can create a culture that works fairly well for everybody. So there's more open communication. They have a better understanding of why you have certain expectations for them to meet the company's needs and the customer's needs. I think there's a real opportunity here.
Yeah, and I think if I could add to that, what I was getting from it as as someone who has run small businesses, is when you mentioned that your employees are about the same age as your clients, and if that's the case, I think that you probably need to be doing a lot more listening than maybe talking, because at that point you have people that are about the same age, and I think we all have to recognize the fact that there is something very valuable with our experience, but yet at the same time, the new education that's coming in and the things that your employees that are able to synergize a little better with some of their clients. Anyway, that would be my thought, and I think that's something that I have seen as well, even in my own companies, is that, if you're dealing with this culture that's that age, understand that your experience is valuable, but what they bring to the table is very important as well. Would you tend
Absolutely.
To agree with that?
I do, and I think that they, really, really listening, getting there, they probably have great ideas, right? Mm-hmm. They're the same age as the customers coming in. Get their ideas, understand what they're experiencing. What they may have some different ways of doing things that could actually make things run easier in the business. So that's where I would start as well. Like really, really learn from them.
So I have a question from Jesse in Florida. I work at a company where it's very gossipy, which creates a split in the team. The employees go to the boss to get her to intervene, and she never does. Have you ever had to come in to a company and explain to the head of the company that she needs to step up and handle her team?
Yes, I absolutely have. So when, gossipy organizations that engage in gossip usually have lower trust, and because gossip, as we know, is an indirect form of communication, and if no one's told people to stop gossiping, they're usually not going to. So I absolutely have worked with leaders where I said, if you continue to let this behavior, gossip or whatever, if the behavior is move, if you continue to let this behavior go unchecked, be unaddressed, etc., this is the outcome you're going to get. You're going to get more of what you're getting now. These are the consequences of this behavior. So I've laid it out for the leader. And most of the time that works really well, because they've never thought about it that way. They're not looking at the consequences of letting the behavior go unchecked.
And is the lack of trust in the boss or in the culture in its entirety within the organization?
So, yeah, it could be related to the boss. It could be in the organization. So, gossip, we're almost never directly addressing an issue, right? So gossip actually takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of time. It's very distracting at work. So it doesn't improve efficiency or production. So it's not even a good business practice, let alone a good human practice.
Right.
So it usually becomes embedded in the culture over time. But I've worked with many companies where we've cleaned up the gossip issue. We've built trust. We've talked a lot about how you need to communicate at work and why, what professionalism looks like. And it is absolutely possible to reverse this and heal it.
Well, I love the fact that you have talked about trust, because I think that's huge in this situation. But what I'd like to ask as we start to get closer towards the end of the show is, mm-hmm. if you could imagine that most businesses now all had brilliant cultures, what do you see the possibility then? You know, give us a picture looking into the future of what we would be mm-hmm. like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It's actually got chills when you asked that question, because I have such a vision for it. And it's one of the reasons I wrote the book that's in the introduction. But it's, you know, when I think about organizations with brilliant cultures, you have, right, companies that are successful in whatever way, whatever that means to them. But I think when you have a culture that's fulfilling its potential, that company is really tuned into how they're impacting the environment, right? They're more interested in being sustainable. They're more interested in maybe creating products and services that help the world. So I think a natural offshoot is that we would see organizations and businesses being huge contributors to the success of our entire planet. Not that they are, certainly many of them are already, but we'd see even more of that. We'd see this innovation that would come into play that I think would actually handle some of our biggest, you know, problems on the planet.
I like that. But I think that ties right into what you were saying before is that if part of the culture is based on the fact that we have a workforce that's more concerned about you know, what we're doing to our planet, or, you know, more concerned with the bigger picture. I think that really, you know, that makes us more, I think, you know, passionate about what it is that we're doing if we feel like we're making a difference. So yeah, I agree. If we can improve the cultures, we improve the passion. If we improve the passion, all of a sudden, you know, we're making huge changes in the way in which people deal with things. I mean, even from the standpoint, I mean, here we're in Southern California, so, you know, we have, you know, road rage and things like that. Well, guess what? If people are happier at work, they're probably not going to be driving home trying to run somebody down. You know, so I think that, and we can take that one step further now, and now they get home. And so they're home and they're dealing with their family, and if you're doing that better. So I think that there's a domino effect to more people being able to imagine the same thing that you're able to imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think there is a domino effect. Yeah, the person comes home, right? They treat their family better, or they have more connected time with the family, right? And so the domino effect just spirals out. Absolutely. Yeah, it matters a lot.
Claudette, there's a question from Dana in Arizona. Her question is, have you had an increase of calls to help organizations on the heels of the Time's Up Me Too movement?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I haven't seen more calls on the heels of that necessarily. What I have noticed is that it's easier to talk about how important culture is on the heels of that. You know, in the sense of people understanding it, like, well, look at the Me Too movement, look at these other movements that have been emerging. They're cultural, right? They're bigger, you know, societal culture. But it's easier to talk about it because people resonate, like, oh, that's what you mean by culture. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, Claudia, I just got to tell you, the time has flown by. This has been great. And again, so for everybody out there, you know, the website is culturalbrilliance.com. I just really want to acknowledge you, Claudette, for taking the time, you know, not only to write the book, but to work with so many different companies to make a difference, which, as I said, I believe has a domino effect. So it's helping people in a lot of different ways. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much. And great to be on the show. I really enjoyed our conversation. Appreciate it.
All right. And again, for everybody out there, if you want to get more information, go to culturalbrilliance.com. If you're driving and you can't write this down, go to answersforthefamily.com, and all of the information will be there for you. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will be joined by Sandra Biskind to discuss Codebreaker, discover the password to unlock the best version of you. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and now on Spreaker. So if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us make a positive difference together. And the next time that you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word. Joelle, thank you so much for being here. Yeah. I love it.
It was a really wonderful show. Thank you so much for having me. And Claudette, thank you for the wonderful work that you're doing. It's really going to help a lot of people.
All right. And so for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.